But he and I, of course, communicated this week, and he had said that he had gone through these first verses in the third chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. So I looked at the first six verses there on page 69 from Matthew 7, 1 through 6. And I thought I would just add one thought to that. Been kind of my favorite approach to this for very many years, because as you look at the passage, of course, verse 1, Matthew 7 to 1, "Do not judge lest you be judged," has been terribly misunderstood to mean that we are never, ever to disagree with anybody, you know, in religious things. And that if you were to ever suggest that someone might be wrong, that they might not actually be a Christian, that they may have been mistaken or deceived, you know, and would need to make some corrections in their lives, well, then clearly you're unchristlike, you're disobedient to this admonition. Jesus has commanded us not to judge, and so we are forbidden, you know, ever to do such a thing as that. And so they would have us believe that simply because someone says they are saved, someone says that they are a Christian, we must therefore accept that and never question that. My favorite approach to this, you know, has always been when somebody whips this first verse out to attack me for saying, let's study, you know, let's see if we can't reach agreement. Maybe, I mean, both of us, any of us, need to make changes in our lives, is this. If you see a judge say that the defendant is guilty as charged, well, what's the purpose of a judge? Is that a judgment? That is, in fact, a judgment. And nobody would want to be, you know, on the receiving end of that. And it is this, of course, that people are crying out against that makes them uncomfortable if anybody says, look, you know, it does not appear that your life or your doctrine or your practice, you know, squares with the Scriptures. Okay, look at this next slide, though. Suppose the judge says the defendant is cleared of all charges, case dismissed. Is that not a judgment? Is that not equally judgmental as the previous slide? Are they not both judgments? You know, they are. And so the humorous, you know, kind of irony of people whipping this verse out so quickly to tell you that you must never, ever cross them or criticize them or try to help them by suggesting that they might be making a mistake or need to make a change. Well, you know, do not judge lest you be judged. What they demand is that you judge them to be saved. What they demand is that you must judge them to be right and pleasing in the sight of God. You are required by them to judge, but you're only required to judge how? You know, positively, favorably. Your judgment must be their judgment, or else you're guilty of violating Matthew 7:1. Well, that's just not fair, and certainly demonstrates the error of that approach. Now, Jerry, I know, did an outstanding job with this. We ourselves are not to set ourselves up as any sort of a standard by which anyone ought to be judged. But if God is the judge, and God has written His judgment into the Scriptures, then what He says when I read it, is that me judging or is that God judging? That's God's judgment, not my judgment. And so unhappily, and I think really it's a large majority of the religious world, has put itself in a terrible position where they are unable to grow. They are unable to learn. They are unable to improve themselves because they choose to believe that they must be right, that they're always right, and anybody that would suggest differently is, you know, is automatically incorrect. Well, if we suggest that improvements need to be made somewhere, that growth might take place, not because we think we're so perfect or anything like that, would be in violation of this passage, but simply because God said something, and it's pretty obvious whether any individual, ourselves included, is actually practicing it. So we'll pass on from that then into this last chapter of Matthew 7. Do all I can to try to finish up with this chapter, maybe even farther here this morning, by looking at the bottom of page 69 and reading there Matthew 7, 7. Ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receives. He who seeks, finds. And to him who knocks, it shall be opened. Now that is a straight up promise. That is God's declaration, His statement that you cannot fail if you are looking for the truth. But as you turn the page now to Matthew 7 and verse 9, he now wants to illustrate the certainty of God fulfilling that promise. He says in verse 9, "Or what man is there among you, when his son shall ask him for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he shall ask for a fish, he'll not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father, who is in heaven, give what is good to those who ask him? Therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets," and that verse is also what we call the what? The golden rule, okay? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You may have noticed, thanks to the helpfulness of these parallel columns, the whole point of having the harmony in its arrangement is that Luke chapter 6 certainly is recording this same event, also telling us about this Sermon on the Mount. But you see how much more information there is from Matthew than there is from Luke. But on page 70, in that right-hand column, in the midst of all that blank space, you can see that Luke chapter 6 and 31 certainly does include, you know, this golden rule, just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. Now, in keeping, though, with this judgment discussion we were just having, how many of you would want your doctor not to tell you if you had some terrible disease? How many of you would want, you know, any mechanic to conceal from you the fact that your car has a problem? You know, how many of us think that this would ever be, you know, good for us? It's not. What we need to know above all things is not when everything's going well, but it's when things are not going so well. And so, when we say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, however you want to be treated, you know, be treated, you know, I want my doctor to tell me if I have a disease. I want somebody to point out if I've made a mistake. I appreciate it when you show me that my charts, you know, have got a misquote on it or something like that. You're never going to take offense. And so, hopefully, brethren, we as Christians will be wide open to both sides of that equation. I need to be judged. I want to be judged. I want to improve. I want to be helped. And so that is how I want to be treated. And if you ever find that that's not the case, that I'm losing my ability to be corrected and to be criticized, well, you'll be sure to come and criticize me on that, won't you? Point that out, and I'll try to make the changes that I can, because that is how I want to be treated. That's how we're all going to be improved. But so what father is going to substitute snakes for fish or rocks for bread? None. What is the guarantee that Jesus gives in Matthew 7 that he invokes in the name of the Father? If you want to know the truth, then what? You absolutely will. God will see to it that you do. He is perfectly capable of providing someone or a Bible, you know, anywhere on planet Earth so that he can fulfill his promise that we can find the truth. I find that, you know, extremely comforting. I've also come to believe that those people who do not accept the truth, who will not, you know, believe these verses, you know, simply demonstrate that they are not people who are asking or seeking, who are knocking. And in all your New Testament, brethren, you'll find few words that are more active and ongoing than those three verbs. Ask, seek, and knock. requires effort. It requires time. It requires, you know, passion. But it requires that you get involved and that you be self-motivated. The promise is that you cannot fail. If you're looking for the truth, your heart is open to the truth, if you have a mind that can receive the truth, then absolutely you will. Now, verse 13, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You'll know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then, you will know them by their fruits. If you will now, look to the right-hand column in the last two verses in Luke 6 there, verses 45 and 46, I mean on that page, Luke 6, 45, the good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil, for his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. And then Jesus asks this rhetorical question, which is not recorded by Matthew. So we have this information from Luke only. He then said to that audience, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Now you go back to verse 21 in the right or left-hand column, Matthew 7, 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Once again, I love all the New American Standard translations for doing this. You'll see it again here in the Harmony. All capital letters in Matthew 7:23. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So they're handing it to you on a silver platter. When Jesus uttered those words, were they the first time those words had ever been spoken? Nope. They come from where? Psalm 6 and verse 8. It's just wonderful how the New American that helps us to see how often Jesus laces Old Testament passages into his preaching. Here's one in the Sermon on the Mount. But remember, he said at the start of the sermon, don't think I came to abolish the law of the prophets. He didn't come to abolish, but to what? To fulfill. And as I pointed out a few weeks ago, not a single thing in this whole sermon that you can't find in your Old Testament. It's all there. He's talking to a number of Jews up on a hill, north shore of the Sea of Galilee. He is telling those people to continue being faithful Jews under the law of Moses. There is no church yet. Jesus hasn't died on the cross yet. He hasn't shed his blood. The gates of Hades will not prevail against that church, but he hasn't built it yet. So, statement here in Matthew 7, and I think you could tell now, everything from the first verse in Matthew 7 is really all about what? Judgments. It's about the need for judgments. It's about proper judgments. It's about the need to be corrected, the desire to be corrected, the promise of God that you can and you will be corrected, and the warning now that we have just seen that. Now, and before I even get into that, I want to go back to this verse 46 in Luke 6. Luke 6, 46, remember Jesus said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? I want you to think for a minute, what is Jesus' life like in these days? Is he popular? Oh my, thousands of people coming to hear him, maybe tens of thousands. They're coming from all great distances and through dangerous circumstances to be able to get to him. And so, all day long, what's one of the major reasons they've been coming to him?
Healing.
It's
for the healing. And can't you just hear the clamor? Lord, Lord, they're begging you. For what? The healing. Lord, Lord, you must be hearing it all day long. It must be hundreds of times, you know, from the distance in the midst of the crowd. People who can't get any closer. Lord, Lord, you know, my heart, my leg, my wife, my children, you know, Lord, Lord. Now, in that context, you see how great it is that Luke helps us here. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, but what? You won't do what I say. Is the first sermon he's preached? Not hardly. So he is. He's healing people. And what is the purpose of the miracles? To confirm the word. So why do you call me Lord, but won't do what I say? It is then, having in that manner, brethren, rebuked, or at least certainly got the attention of these people, that he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Who goes to heaven? Who enters the kingdom of heaven? Those who do the will of the Father. Not those who are just mouthing about how much they love him and appreciate him and want him to do things for them. That's not it at all. It's down to action. It is down to a pure and undefiled religion, to use James' term, where, you know, that rubber meets the road, where you are active, where you are involved, where you are participating. We are not spectators. The Jews weren't, and we are not to be either, as the rest of the New Testament will abundantly testify. So, going to be a lot of surprised people, aren't there, in verse 22. Do they think that they love the Lord? Do they think that they're his disciples? Do they think that when they say, Lord, Lord, they mean it, that they're in submission, that they're responsive, that he commands and they obey? To the extent, brethren, that some of them apparently actually are working miracles. Does the ability to work a miracle prove that your sins are forgiven, you're a member of the kingdom of God, and you're pleasing and right in the sight of God? Well, not hardly. When the donkey spoke in the Old Testament, I'd call that a miracle. Does that mean that donkey's right with God and going to heaven? Is that a ringing endorsement of the donkey's faith? No! When the high priest prophesied, much later, we'll get to that in due time, that one man must die for the nation. And we are told, because he was high priest, he was prophesying. What was he also doing at that moment? Participating in the fulfillment. He was crucifying Jesus. He's responsible for the death of Jesus. And simultaneously prophesying how he must die. Does that mean that that Pharisaic high priest was pleasing in the sight of God? God picked him because he had such a good heart? No, certainly not. So, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord. Many will say to me, Lord, didn't we prophesy, cast out demons, perform many miracles? And what does he declare to them? I never knew you. It's not that I did and you fell away. I never knew you. And what are they practicing? Matthew 7:23. Quote from Psalm 6. Last word. Lawlessness. They're just lawless miracle workers. Whether they actually worked a miracle or self-deceived, I can't tell you. Either way, lawless. Therefore, Jesus says at the top of page 71 in Matthew 7:24. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man who built his house upon the rock. The rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and burst against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded upon the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act upon them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended and the floods came,
the winds blew and burst against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. So he gives us this parable. He gives us this illustration. What's the point of the illustration? Many will be surprised when they discover that he never knew them. To which, of course, the audience immediately says, but Lord, Matthew 7:1, judge not. Is that what they did? Oh, brethren, what the verse says in 28, there in the middle of page 71, again, only Matthew tells us this, but the result was that when Jesus had finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. Now, I understand the difference, and I recognize Jesus is the judge. He has the right to judge. I'm being a little facetious there, you know, but brethren, this is why your New Testament was written, so you could hold it in your hand and let the Lord judge, so you could prepare yourself before that judgment, so you could be ready for that judgment. And so one day, you too can say, Lord, Lord. And his response will be, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And not, I never knew you, depart from me, you worker of lawlessness. Now, some translations have iniquity. So as the Sermon on the Mount ends, does it end on what you would call really an upbeat note? Not really. It's a warning. Yea, verily, it's a threat. How did the sermon start? Blessed. Is that an upbeat? Boy, that thing started great, didn't it? All right. You can see, anybody in the audience would be able to identify with some of the Beatitudes. Everybody is doing some of those things, some one of them, you know, anyway. And so it just starts on this great, you know, upbeat note. What's the body of the sermon all about? Let's get our act together. Okay? Here, people, is how you are. Never forget, context of the sermon. Here's how you are a faithful what? Here's how you be a faithful Jew. Now, certainly, as Christians, we can take these words, we can apply these words, the apostles are going to use this, you know, all that's well and good. But just reminding us, the Jews can do this, we can do this. What is the sermon about? Getting your act together so that ultimately you become a sayer or a doer. James. See, this is what that sermon is all about. So we take it to heart and say, okay, I am. Read this entire New Testament. I am going to find myself on his pages frequently failing. I am going to rise up and make those corrections and do something about that. And I am not going to be somebody that's a hearer and not a doer. I'm going to be involved in this thing, and I'm going to demonstrate that I believe what the Lord has said. I am going to be his disciple. I'm going to build my house then on what? Got to build it on that rock. Now, by the way, back to verse 13 on page 70, I forgot to point out, you know, one of these fun slides, I guess, but not a soul, I don't think, in this room is well aware of this, but King James Version, of course, says that the way is what? Straight. Remember? How does the King James Version, which is the one most people are familiar with still, if the way is straight, how do they spell straight? In the King James Version of 1611, it's spelled S-T-R-A-I-T. Is there any G-H in there? No. And once again, so many people think it means, you know, straight, like laser. It's not what it means. So as you look at Planet Earth right there, and we zoom in down to the very southern part of the continent we know as South America, what are we looking at right there? The what of Magellan? It is the Strait of Magellan. Is there any G-H in that word, straight? No. And is that thing the least bit straight? You want to cut off an enormous amount of sailing distance and leave yourself less exposed
to the dreadful consequences of what weather can do out on the open sea, rather than sailing around the tip of South America, what do you do right here? You come in through what is not straight GH at all. But what is it? It's really narrow next to the open sea. But it's also very sheltered. You know, all these mountains and everything are protecting you from the weather in through there.
So what Jesus said is that way is narrow. It is constricted, as the New American Standard does. And remember that as, of course, you're working with your friends and neighbors. This brings us to page 71. And we're going to be looking at Luke 7 in this case. Matthew 8 also records this event. We're going to look at Luke 7. Now, I want to tell you right at the outset, brethren, this is one of the few places where you really do have a head scratcher. And one of the few places, get ready for it, where your skeptics and your Bible deniers and the people that are trying to destroy confidence in the Bible appear to really have a good case. You need to be prepared for it. What Matthew says and what Luke says about what is absolutely, certainly, the same identical event is very different. Very, very different. And kind of shockingly so. And so let's see about this now. I'm going to start with Luke 7:1. When he had completed all his discourse in the hearing of the people, he went where? Capernaum. What's the city been called? It's Jesus' hometown. He made that his base. And a certain centurion slave, who was highly regarded by him, the centurion, was sick and about to die. Is it bad? And when he heard about Jesus, what did the centurion do in verse 3? He sent some Jewish, elders, asking him to come and save the life of his slave. What's verse 4 say in Luke 7? When they who? The Jewish elders had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, he's worthy for you to grant this to him. But now, the identical event recorded by Matthew, chapter 8, verse 1. When he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. When he had entered Capernaum, what's the next phrase say? A centurion came to him. What's the next phrase say? Entreating him. What does the next thing say? We're in verses 5 and 6 now. Let's skip 2, 3, and 4. Verse 6. And what? Saying, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering great pain. So, brethren, which is it? Who's right and who's wrong? Is Matthew telling the truth or is Luke telling the truth? Is Matthew right that the centurion went and made a personal appeal? Or is Luke right, which is perfectly understandable and justifiable, that he rather chose to stay home with his near-to-die, loved one? Which is it? Okay, and Carol's, absolutely got it there. And it really, with a little bit of thought, it is not that big of a problem. If I send and ask somebody to do something for me, who's asking for something to be done? It's me. And ultimately, if I tell these people what to say when they go and make this request, who is speaking? When I read the words to you, judge not that you be not judged. Who is speaking? No matter what you say, I'm going to say, well, you're just wrong. If you say, God is speaking, well, it was me. You heard me. And if you say, well, there I heard you. You're speaking. Well, no. It was God. Which one's right, Carol? Both of them. They're both right. And if you try to make a conflict out of that, you just say more about your own heart than you do about, you know, really being an active truth seeker. So there's really not a problem here at all. But on the surface, it really does look like we would have what you would call, you know, a contradiction. It's not so. There's nothing here in these two passages that is contradictory at all. Okay, pardon me. My book is kind of stiff here and flipped all those pages and I lost my place. Okay, so I can get this thing to stay put. All right, so I'm going to turn the page now on to page 72 and see the response. Let's pick up the reading at verse, we'll use the Luke column, Luke chapter 7, and we'll pick up with 5. His messengers have continued. He loves our nation. It was he who built us our synagogue. So they're saying he's worthy. Verse 6. Now Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent what? Friends, saying to him, whose words? Centurions, Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I, too, am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. Now, why did the man bring all that up? He is saying to Jesus, I understand what it is to give a command that must be obeyed. I've been on the receiving end of commands that must be obeyed. I am on the giving end of commands that must be obeyed. Lord, if you will but command, then your command must be obeyed. So please, give the command for my servant's sake. Now, let's finish this with verse 10 in the Matthew column. So Matthew 8:10. When Jesus heard this, he marveled. And he said to those who were following, truly I say to you, I've not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. And I say to you that many shall come from east and west and recline with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom shall be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said to the centurion, through whom? Jesus is now himself sending a message. Go your way, verse 13. Let it be done to you as you believed. The servant was healed when? Instantly. And so, it's actually fortified. You have the servants and you have the centurion. Where is the centurion? So that he is a witness on that end of our problems. He's at home with the sick one. What are the servants doing? They're going back and forth. And when they're in the presence of Jesus, what are they able to testify to? See? When the event takes place. And so what we have is not contradiction. It's not some reason to be less confident in the Scriptures, but more. We have witnesses on both ends. We do not have just one witness. We have differing witnesses with differing responsibilities in life, and they both testify that this event took place, and here's exactly how that event took place. So, when the Lord works a miracle, is it in bits and pieces? No. It's right now, and it's 100%. Okay. So then, that leads us, again my pages, I'm sorry. I told you in my book. You can see how these blue pages are right here. I took my Harmony, which I have used for years and years and extensively, and I had it rebound with a regular New Testament put under the same cover there at the back. And so it makes it twice as thick as yours is. So mine keeps flipping when I'm in these early pages. It won't lay open. Got to get a big paperweight here. Okay, so that brings us then to Luke chapter 7, the only one who tells us about the widow at Nain. And that being the case, before we read that, if you look at the screen here, this will be the last couple of slides I've got for this class. But that's just a Google Earth satellite photo, of course, of what country of the three in Jesus' day that comprise Israel, what province is this? This is the Sea of... So what's the area? Galilee. That's Galilee. Where's Jesus' hometown? Right there next to the water on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. Where is Nain, where the widow is? Well, at the point of the arrow right there, which is right in the middle almost of what is known as the Valley of Jezreel, some of the most fertile country in Israel. That's 22 miles if you could get a book ticket with a crow. You'd have to go across, you know, a major portion of the lake right there to get that done. If, however, according to Google Earth, you were to go there, you know, on asphalt, then it'd be about 30 miles. And as you can see, brethren, then and now, you have to follow the trails. You have to follow the roads. And so Jesus is about 30 miles away. That's something to think about as you're reading through all these passages. Capernaum may be Jesus' what? Hometown. And an awful lot of people coming from all over Israel, not just Galilee in the north, but what in the middle? Samaria, and what in the south? Judah or Judea. Okay? They're coming from all this territory. They're coming from Syria. They're coming from Tyre. They're coming from everywhere. But Jesus is not just sitting in an easy chair, you know, there by the sea with his feet soaking. He is really moving around. So at this point, Capernaum is the hometown. He's the man from Galilee, but he's also 30 miles away. And this is the city of Nain. In 2011, as you know, I went for a second time to Israel and had the blessing of my life, I guess, and being permitted to spend an entire week with Farrell Jenkins, just the two of us, driving whithersoever he wanted to go. And so we bought gas at this location, and he, while he was tanking up the car, that had to do without me, as I ran across the street and out into the field, and I snapped this picture. He's pumping gas. I said, oh, by the way, that's Nain over there. So I go running to snap these pictures. But there's Nain to this day, tiny little community nestled up against the hillside right there. As you zoom in, you can see that they're cultivating the fields. They had just done some cropping, you know, here, took some wheat or barley or something down when we were there. But I want you to also take a closer look at these houses. There are, in this town today, no more than 200 houses. I know, because thanks to Google Earth, I can count right from space. It wasn't any bigger than that in Jesus' time, so far as we can tell. It's a tiny little village. But what do you notice about these 200 houses? What do you see about almost every single one of them, it looks like? How tall are they? And can you count and tell me? How tall are they?
3 to 4 stories.
3 to 4 stories. I found this kind of curious in just a sort of societal commentary, I guess. Now, in America, you know, you have a generation, and you marry and you have children, so now you have a second generation. What is the main goal in life for you as parents and that second generation when it comes to living quarters? Get them out of here as soon as we can. See? Go live by yourself. Go get married, have your own kids, and live where? Near is okay, even better, but not here. You know, somewhere across town, or I can ask you when I want. What you'll discover in these cultures, of course, is that they're much closer-knit families, and they stay together. There's a reason why you will see by the tens of thousands, three-story houses, both in the Palestinian areas and in Israeli-controlled areas. It's because who's living on the bottom floor? Right down here. Grandma and Grandpa. Okay. And who doesn't, you know, want to climb the stairs? Grandma and Grandpa. So who lives in the middle? Okay. And who's living on top? The newlyweds, make them climb the stairs. That's all that. But families are all living together. You're going to see this everywhere you go. What also do you notice about the roofs? That fourth story, typically, is the big patio that's up on top of the roof. So to this day, they are still living with flat roofs. They are still living, you know, in these multiple-story structures, which Josephus talks quite a bit about. And so you have, you know, the generations living together there. So as you drive around in Israel, often you'll think, well, look at all these apartment buildings. Well, yeah, and they do. They'll rent apartment spaces. But many of them, maybe even most of them, are just families. Okay, we got 5 more minutes, and right where I was hoping to be. So let's have a look now at this resurrection. Luke chapter 7, 11, it came about soon afterwards, and he went to a city called Nain. How far is he from Capernaum by foot? About 30-mile walk. His disciples are going along with him. They're all hiking. Accompanied by how many? These people are serious about hearing Jesus' word. So as he approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother. She was a widow. Sizable crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her. And he said to her, "Do not weep." And he came up and he touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. So I rather think what happened was he put himself right in front of that procession like this, and as they kept coming, he wasn't budging till they stopped with his hand on the coffin. And so, you know, that's most unusual, to say the least. I've only seen one such procession interrupted, you know, like that. Maybe tell you about that in another minute. But he came up and he touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt, and he said, "Young man, how does he know who's in there? I say to you, what? Arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And Jesus gave him back to his mother. And fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report concerning him went out all over what? Judea. Judea is a long way to the south. You got all Samaria between here and there. And in all the surrounding district. So, when Jesus works a miracle, who finds out about it? Everybody. And when Jesus works a miracle, who gets to witness it? To everybody. And when Jesus works a miracle, is there any way that it can be a mistake or a fake? Never. Too many witnesses. And mother's not about to bury her boy and he's still breathing. She knows he's dead, as does everybody else in the procession. So, somebody walks up and stops a coffin, you got the whole town's full attention. Somebody says, "Young man, arise," and he does. What's the first response? Terror. Never forget that. I'm thinking even the mother was taken aback. But he explains, and then goes his way. Now, to close the class, and really not directly related, but since I, you know, said, I've only one time seen a funeral interrupted, and it was one of the most heartbreaking things I ever saw. That woman, a member of the church that I visited and known, you know, passed away. Her daughter was not a Christian, and probably in her 40s. And we had the service, you know, the service was over, the coffin was being borne out to the car so it could go to the cemetery. And the daughter completely lost it. It was the single display of grief, most intense, that I've ever witnessed in my life. And she grabbed hold of the coffin and she wouldn't let it move. And we had quite a scene. It lasted for quite a while, weeping, wailing, just absolutely hysterically, you know, out of her mind. And she just couldn't let it happen, couldn't let it go. And so for quite a while there, we, you know, were wondering what to do and how to handle this. And eventually the funeral home people had been through this before, you know, it was new to us. But, you know, they came and they forced her not to leave. They just dragged her away. And that burial took place. Suppose the widow in Nain was any less unhappy. Now, but how did her day end up? Believe that there's a God in heaven, that Jesus is his son. He had the power to rise from the dead and did himself. We are his servants. He is our Lord. Lord. So build your house where? On a rock. Because not everybody that says Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom. But those who what? Go and do thou likewise.